I heard them once. I was in a very bad mood. I was at a club and heard them. And the sort of sound they were making was a sound I hadn't heard before, and I was just totally knocked out. I suppose I felt there was a sort of freshness about what they were doing. There was a sort of freedom about the way they were playing. They weren't just hacking through the old numbers, playing all the old hits of yesterday and today, and sort of you didn't feel that there was a sort of a regimented group just going through the motions. You know, there was a sort of fantastic liveness about it, and these sort of huge sheets of sound were building up, you know, and this was a sound I hadn't heard before, and I immediately was completely knocked out by it and started getting interested in them. The sort of whole light scene and things like this sort of came out of, from, I suppose, a different direction. I mean, the way this did come from quotes, the psychedelic movement sort of thing, as far as I was concerned. It's always been a thing which I've dug, you know. I've always thought that lights and music and things like that and sounds and vision should all go together. And it sort of seemed the right time for it to happen. I think another thing which is very important is that, you know, one feels that the pop market, as it were, is now capable of taking something far more than it used to. You know, previously it was all sort of Jim Reeves and very sort of simple things played over and over again. But increasingly I noticed that clubs, that the thing which always seemed to get the really huge applause always were the instrumentals, the things when the musicians really gave themselves a chance to really do something new and different. And sort of out of this whole sort of rock and roll movement, you've got a sort of an instantly attractive beat, a very strong beat, a very powerful beat, which anyone can respond to. And then on top of this, you've got the electronic thing, which gives you this fantastic dynamics and excitement and an ability just to sort of pierce through people's sometimes deadness, you know. One can penetrate right through into their minds, almost sheerly by sort of volume and sound and noise and distortion. It gives a tremendous increased awareness of what's going on. You know, you hear things much more. When you finish listening to Pink Floyd, you don't just clap and sort of hum the tune they've just been playing. You just go, whoa! You know, it's an experience. You've been through a total sort of sensory experience, both visual and audio. And I think this has an appeal not only to intellectuals. I mean, there's a lot of in common, say, between the Pink Floyd and what people like Albert Ayler and Ornette Coleman are doing, but it's got also an immediacy of appeal to the kids, which I think is great. And it's a sort of a common denominator which can go right across. Anyone can dig the Pink Floyd, I think.
Can you capture this strictly on sound? Let's say in terms of recordings.
I think our records will be very different from our stage shows. I think our records inevitably, first of all, there's a 3-minute limitation. Secondly, you can't sort of walk around the kitchen humming to the Pink Floyd. I mean, if you had a Pink Floyd, the sort of sound they're making in the clubs, coming over the radio while you're doing the washing up, you'd probably scream. I suspect that our records are bound to have to be much more audio, much more, you know, they are written for a different situation. Listening to a gramophone record in your home or on the radio is very different from going into a club or into a theater and watching a stage show. They're two different things. It requires a different approach. We think we can do both.
The voice of Peter Jenner, one of the Floyd's early managers.
Well, Sid Barrett was the group in those days, and Sid was the main writer. And it was a pretty difficult job, actually, with Sid, because I think Sid used music, I put it this way, used music with sort of lyrical phrasing, or if you like, he used lyrics with sort of musical phrasing. And it was a statement being made at a given time. That meant that if you came back 5 minutes later to do another take, you probably wouldn't get the same performance. You probably wouldn't get the same tune or musical composition. because it was that kind of a statement at that one particular time. So it wasn't too easy for a producer to be able to, I mean, it virtually made editing impossible, for instance, if one wanted to edit, because you didn't get the same performance. And I think, if I remember rightly, we went through quite a few of Sid's songs, and yeah, it played me a few, and it was very difficult to figure out which I liked and which I didn't like, so we come back and maybe try these songs again, and there's a different version. And then even more difficult. So the early days were quite difficult, really. It was a very slow sort of unwinding process.
The other individuals in the band. Dave Gilmore, who plays guitar on this track, was brought in to replace the ailing Barrett, and Nick Mason remembers some of the feelings that prevailed at that time.
I mean, it's easy now to look back on the past and try and sort of give it some shape and form, but at the time you're in a total state of confusion, muddling about, because you're trying to be in this band and be successful or make it work, and things aren't working out, and you don't really understand why. You can't believe that someone's deliberately trying to screw it up, and yet half of the other half of you saying, this man's crazy, he's trying to destroy me. And destroy me, I mean, it gets very personal, that, you know, you get very worked up into a state of extreme rage. And I mean, obviously there were some incredible moments of clarity where you realise that things are not right, like the wonderful American tour, which will live forever. Sid detuning his guitar all the way through one number, striking the string and detuning the guitar, which is very modern, but very difficult for a band to follow or play with. And other occasions where he'd more or less just cease playing and stand there, leaving us to muddle along as best we could. And times like that you think, what we need is someone else, or at least some help.
Nick actually came to me and sort of nudge, if such and such happened, and if this and if that, would you be interested at all, and went through that whole thing in a sort of fairly roundabout way, suggested that this might come off at some point. And then just after Christmas, right after the Olympia gig, I actually got a phone call where I was staying. I didn't have a phone, actually, or they didn't know it, but they sent a message through someone else that they knew me,
for me to get in touch for taking the job, so to speak. There was no real discussion or any meetings to think about it or any auditions or anything like that. They just said, did I want to? And I said yes, and it was as simple as that.
Gilmore remembers.
It was totally impossible for me to understand the way Sid's mind was working at that time. It was also, from having been to two or three of their gigs, impossible for me to see how they could carry on like that. Because Sid very obviously wasn't up to being in that group at that time, doing what he was doing. It just was painfully obvious that they were just kind of marking time at that moment. And actually joining the group was a very difficult thing, because originally there was some kind of a plan for there to be five people and for Sid to phase out of the live thing and but keep on writing. But we realised that that was an impossibility almost as soon as we'd thought of it, or they'd thought of it. So that idea very rapidly got dropped. We did do three or four gigs with five people playing. Pretty strange. Confident enough to actually start playing myself, where I actually sat there mostly playing just rhythm guitar, and I suppose, to be honest, at the time trying to sound a bit like Sid, but that didn't last very long. I mean, it was obvious the group had to change into something completely different. And they hadn't asked me to join to sound exactly like Sid. But I mean, the numbers that they were doing were still Sid's numbers mostly. Consequently, I mean, there's kind of a fixed thing in your head of how they have been played previously. And that kind of makes it very much harder for you to strike out on your own and do it exactly how you would do it, and you haven't got a clue how you would do it really, because there's already an imprinted thing in your brain of how the guitar is played on those things. Consequently, it did take some time before I started getting into actually being a member of the band and feeling free to impose my own guitar playing style on it.